We're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 3, and I have to admit this is probably one of my favorite chapters in the Bible, has been since I was a little kid. Now part of it is when I was a child, there was a song that had the refrain in it, the three children in the fiery furnace. Children, and I was a child, and like, wow, what a great story about what kids can do. Okay, well then I got to be teens and found out, well, these weren't kids. They actually had been captured when they were in their teens, probably mid-late teens. And then it was like, wow, this is only chapter 3, so they can't be very old. They're about the same age as I am, or maybe a little older. And look how they defy that terrible king. Well, I was a teen, and I didn't like authoritarianism. And I thought, great, here's a model. I can stand like they can and defy authoritarian people. Well, that's not what it's about either. And as I've had opportunity to study this more and more as I've gotten older, I've really become to appreciate the book of Daniel in depth. And this particular chapter even more is appreciating not only an example of the faithfulness and integrity of the three men we're going to be looking at here, but even more so when we see God at work and his amazing character, first of all, just in being patient with Nebuchadnezzar. That actually comes through in chapter 2, 3, and 4, his amazing patience with this pagan king, but as he demonstrates that he is the Most High God, he is the Supreme One, and squashes the pagan gods, their whole pantheon. So turn over there to Daniel chapter 3. The chapter begins with Nebuchadnezzar erecting a statue and then commanding everyone to bow down and worship it. Daniel chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits, and its width 6 cubits. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, counselors, and treasurers, the judges and magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces, to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." Therefore, at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. A little bit of repetition there with recounting all the people who had to come and all these different instruments. There's also a lot of speculation about what some of those things mean and the timing of this event and the image itself. Now, some insist that this occurs after Nebuchadnezzar or soon after Nebuchadnezzar had his dream in chapter 2, which we looked at the last couple weeks. And they base it on the fact that the image is made of gold. Remember the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, the head was gold, it was him, and therefore they try and tie those two things together. But that's all an assumption. The description of the image is very vague. It describes it only its size and the material that was used, and it's odd. It's 9 feet wide. It's 90 feet tall. Now, if the average person is about 18 inches, one cubit, you'd have to be about 15 feet tall. So an average width person is 15 foot tall. All right? That's you, Jonathan Clare. Okay? Imagine, Jonathan, 15 feet tall. Boy, you'd have to really duck coming in, wouldn't you? All right? Now talk about string bean, because that's what you'd look like, just like a pole. The other thing is this image, we're not told exactly what it's made, is it? We don't know what it's made, what it looks like. There's nothing in the text that says it looked like a human. We don't know what it was. So there's a lot of assumptions that get going on, and I just want to point some of these things out and make sure you know those are assumptions. The text doesn't indicate it. It's just this odd proportions. Now, the entire image is made of gold, and it's possible. There was enough gold in Babylon to make this thing a solid gold, but engineering-wise, it probably wouldn't make sense. Gold is too soft. It would begin collapsing on itself. So probably made of either stone or wood and then overlaid, which was a common way that, quote-unquote, golden vessels were made. In fact, most of the materials in the temple were made the same way. They were made out of wood and then overlaid with gold. So that's probably what it was. But you can imagine, whatever it is, it's pretty dazzling in appearance. Now, we also would have to say that any idea that this gold reflects the dream is, again, speculation, because that's contrary to what it says, right? Because the image that he had was the head was gold, the chest and the arms were silver, the belly and the upper thighs were bronze, the legs were iron, and then the feet were iron mixed with clay. That doesn't match. Now, it's possible, maybe Nebuchadnezzar was doing this as a defiance. I'm the head of gold and my kingdom will never end. And that's a possibility. The text doesn't say anything about that. It's also possible that it's gold and it's done this way because the chief god in their pantheon was Marduk. He was the god of gold. That's why it was so important. There is some religious aspect to this image, whatever it was. They are to bow down and they are to worship it. It's not just give a reverence by kneeling before it. They are to worship it. There is some religious significance to it, though the text doesn't give us the particulars of it. Now, the reality of this is that the timing and the specifics of the image are vague on purpose. They're not that important. That's not what the text is about. This has not been recorded for us, so we have some sort of insight into Babylonian history and practices. What's being recorded here is demonstrating the power of the true God and the faithfulness of his followers. That's what's in view throughout this whole text. There is a powerful God that is far superior to anything the Babylonians had. And if you'd made it just one particular God, it would be taken away from that. So leave it vague. All gods of the Babylonians are inferior to the true God. And that's going to be demonstrated. Now this image is set up, it says, on the plains of Dura. Now Dura is simply a term that means a place enclosed by a wall. It could be a lot of places. There was, interesting in archaeology, there was a place found about 6 miles southeast of Babylon. There was a mound found with a brick construction that would have served as a good base for this thing. It's in the plain of a valley, and that in itself would make it even more astounding as you looked at this very tall image, all simply to magnify the importance. Now, we look at all these different officials that are gathered. Now, admittedly, we're not sure exactly what all these officials are and what capacity they held, but they're high government officials. They would range our equivalent, satraps would be like a regional governor of some sort, and then all the way down to magistrates, that'd be like local judges. These are the officials of his kingdom, and that's who he has asked to come. So that in itself tells us there's some sort of political thing going on as well. If it was just about worship of this thing and a god, well, why not just have the people of Babylon flood out and go out and worship it? But he has called all the officials of his kingdom to come and assemble before this thing and then bow down and worship it. So there's some religious thing going on and there's some political thing going on at the same time. Now, after they're all gathered and they hear what we will just call the Babylonian orchestra, okay? Because you got all sorts of instruments, and you who had different versions, you saw it was translated differently, all these different instruments. We're not quite sure what some of these things are, but we would summarize it this way. There are wind instruments, horns, there are reed instruments, and there are string instruments. And what do we have in an orchestra? Oh, we have wind instruments, reed instruments, and string instruments. I guess they have an orchestra. So we'll just call it an orchestra, all right? And then to catch anything else, it says all kinds of music. Now, you can imagine if you've ever been to a performance of a full orchestra, it can get pretty loud, can it? Well, that was the point. When you hear all this going on, now here's the clue, pay attention, bow down and worship this thing. And that's what was expected. Bow down and worship this thing. Now, in a pagan polytheistic society, the idea of worshiping this image is no big deal. Why? You're just adding one more god to the pantheon. So what? One more god doesn't make a whole lot of difference. You can still worship whatever god you desire. Just add the king's god or gods. That's all that's being required of them. Now, such worship as that was also tied to a political reality. The king wants you to worship his god or gods. Why? Because in the king's mind, the reason he's in power is because of these gods or gods, and he does not want to offend them, lest he no longer have his power and success. So don't offend my gods, worship my gods, worship whatever you want, but you got to worship my gods too. That's loyalty to the king. At the same time then, with that in mind, if you did not fall down and worship this image, you're going to be demonstrating a disloyalty to the king. That's dangerous. And this king apparently had some sort of fear that the people may be present, aren't necessarily that loyal. And so he has this very strong warning. You either do what I ask you, or we're going to burn you up in a fire immediately. And this is no idle threat. We find that in Jeremiah 29:22, that the king of Babylon roasted Zedekiah and Ahab in the fire as the means of execution. This is nothing new. I don't know about you, but I don't like getting burned. Most people don't. The idea of being thrown in a furnace of fire has a compelling interest, doesn't it? Now, for a pagan, then it's no big deal. But we already saw in chapter 1, there were four men who were captured Jews that already demonstrated faithfulness to a different god. They already understand that Exodus chapter 20 commands them they may not worship any kind of idol. They may not bow down to it. That's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, or their Israeli names, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Daniel 3, verse 8. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image you have set up. Now you'd think Nebuchadnezzar would have somebody, some official somewhere, sort of designated that we're going to play it, you watch to see who doesn't bow down. Some sort of police official. If he's already concerned that he has to give that kind of a strong warning, you're going to get burned up if you don't do this, he's got someone watching. That's not who brings the accusation. It's the Chaldeans. Remember meeting them back in chapter 2 earlier on? They're the vision. They were one of the groups of wise men. There were four different groups that made up all the wise men. And the Chaldeans are obviously jealous because Daniel, at the end of it, is placed not only as governor over the province of Babylon, he is made the prefect, the head of all the wise men. And then Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael are made high administrative officials within the province of Babylon. That's the positions they want. What are you doing making these young Jews, probably late teens, early 20s, over us, in charge for us? That, they don't like that. Now, again, we don't know when this happened. It could have been early on. It could be many years later. But if it's many years later, you can imagine these Chaldeans have been chafing at this. These young Jews from some other country, this is our nation. This is our prestige. We're the important ones in it. And you've made these other ones. So out of this, they have come, and they're the ones who make the accusations. Now, I need to mention something here that's not in the text. Where's Daniel? It's not in the text. And there's a lot of speculation about it, but the text doesn't give us any kind of indication. Some suggested he viewed this as simply a political exercise, and therefore he bowed down and there's no problem. But that would be very against Daniel's very character, as he's demonstrated already in chapter 1 and chapter 2. Some have said, well, Daniel wasn't present for some reason. Perhaps he's away doing the king's business. Except the king called out all of his officials. So, I don't know. Now, it's possible he needed someone to go do something and he wasn't present. Another idea is Daniel's position was too high for them to accuse him. You know, you can only accuse so high and then you're in trouble. So they didn't accuse him. Perhaps the king even exempted Daniel. And I guess I kind of lean this way. The king already knew something about Daniel because Daniel had interpreted the dream and that Daniel worshipped a God that was a great God. And he may have exempted Daniel because he already knew the God that Daniel worshipped was a superior God. A great God, a God of gods, a God of kings. So it's possible Daniel was exhibited. Now, all those have possibilities, but we don't know. The text doesn't tell us. But for whatever reason, Daniel's not in this text. He is not being charged. He's not being accused. And so the focus goes on to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, the accusations that have been made against them are really in keeping what evil people have always done to God's people. Accuse them falsely of all sorts of stuff, slander them, anything they can do to be against them. Remember what Jesus prepared us for, the same thing, telling us in Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:10? Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. This is nothing new. Blessed are those who, when men cast insults at you, persecute you, say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecute the prophets who are before you. This is nothing new. Expect it. The Chaldeans went to the king, reminded him that he had given this command of a penalty for not bowing down to the worship of this golden image. And they point out, these certain Jews, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, whom you appointed over the province of Babylon, they're not obeying your command. There's three accusations, three specifics. The first one, they disregard the king. That's designed to make the refusal to bow down very personal. You, O king, we admire you. They disregard you. These are terrible men. You understand the point. The second one, they do not serve your gods. Now again, that is an affront to Nebuchadnezzar too, and a scary one. Again, the king had acknowledged Daniel's God as being great God, a God of gods, but he does not believe this is the supreme God. Not yet. It's coming, but not yet. So to affront his God, whom Nebuchadnezzar believes has placed him in this position as king, and who is making his kingdom successful, to affront his God is to risk the kingdom. Because what if the God now turns his favor and doesn't decide somebody else should be king, since the king can't control his people, and force them to worship? So that's a serious affront, and he's going to take it seriously. And third, they do not worship the image which you have set up. That ties the first two together. You're disobeying the king's command, which consists of disregarding the king and disregarding your gods, O king. Now, the Chaldeans were successful in getting the king to take action. In fact, they may have been too successful. The king loses his temper. And Proverbs warns us about that. We should not lose our temper, because when we do, we lose our wisdom. Proverbs 12:6 states, a fool's vexation is known at once, but a prudent man conceals his dishonor. The king's vexation was on his face. Proverbs 29:11 adds, a fool always loses his temper, but a wise man holds it back. God is going to use even Nebuchadnezzar losing his temper to glorify himself. Look at verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in a rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready At the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you will not worship, you will immediately be cast in the midst of a furnace of blazing fire, and what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? So in rage and in anger, he has them brought. And yet it appears that Nebuchadnezzar has some regard for these three men. Maybe he saw through the jealousy of the Chaldeans. Maybe he understood their importance within the province and decides we're going to give them a second chance. Because the command originally was, as if you don't do this, you're immediately going to the fire. And instead of going immediately to the fire, it's bring them to me, and he personally questions them. He repeats everything, including the warning, but then he adds this. What God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Now, two possible reasons or combination would cause him to make that statement. The first is the king is so proud and arrogant that he thinks even the gods can't rescue, or he thinks that whatever religious significance has had towards his own God is a superior God, and the other gods couldn't help you because my God is better, or a combination of the two of them. But that challenge is the setup that's going to ultimately bring glory to the true God. What God can rescue you out of my hands? He's going to find out. Now, the answer that these men give is a model for how all of us who follow the true God should respond when challenged about being obedient first and foremost to him. Look at verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Now, they're not being rude, but they're being extremely direct. The first statement is simply one of this. In view of the king's statement, there's no reason to try and explain why they would not bow down to this idol. So they're not going to give an explanation. There's not a need for one. Instead, they simply go on and they state their faith in their own God and his abilities. That's first. And then they state their willingness to submit to this God regardless of the outcome. Period. Contrary to all the king's claims of absolute power to condemn them, they knew their lives are in the hands of their God. And they were at peace, even if that obedience means their death. Now, we look at the story from the end. We're familiar with it. They don't know the end of the story, do they? They know very well they could be thrown in this fire and that's it. That's the end of their life. There are many times when obedience to God can result in persecution, even to the point of martyrdom. Christian history is absolutely filled with these stories of those in obedience to God who have been persecuted and put to death, some in absolutely horrible manners. That continues to this day. We have brothers and sisters in Christ who this day are being persecuted. Some will probably yield their life today in obedience to God. So this is no just mere story. This is reality, and they understood it. But they're at peace. They're at complete peace if that's what's going to happen. How different life would be if we as professing Christians would have the kind of trust that these men show in God's abilities and then would yield ourselves in trust to him for whatever the outcome may be. Now, such trust and submission results in a holy life and has a peace that passes all comprehension. It has a confidence when facing the future, even when it looks bleak. I think that most of us would like to believe that if we were in their place, we'd do the same thing. But whether you would or not depends actually on how you face situations now. They don't have to be so dramatic. The reality is we do face similar situations. They're not at the cost of your lives, but they may be the cost of something else. How are you doing at facing those same tests? Do you have a trust in the God that we serve, the God that created us, the God that redeemed us in Christ? Are you willing to place your life completely at His hands, at His disposal, and your future is completely up to Him, whatever it may be, good or bad from your perspective? I want to ask a couple questions concerning just different situations. How do you deal with peers? Peers, those who are your same group that you look to for affirmation. Some simple ones, okay? Your friends are going to go to a movie. You looked at the movie reviews, and you find that it glorifies immorality and blasphemes God. What are you going to do? The same kind of test. You're spending some time with your friends, but they're drinking and getting intoxicated. Now what? What are you going to do? Three, you're enjoying an activity with your friends, but now they're breaking the posted rules, and they want you to join in with them. These are realities. These things happen all the time. We face them all the time. How is that really that much different than what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are facing? Except our lives are not at risk. Do we really trust God? Are we willing to leave the consequences in His hands if we obey Him? How about school pressure? And I know you kids don't like me talking about school when it's just August. Wait until mid-September when you're already there and then talk about it. Give us a break. It's August, but it's coming. So let me throw some things out for you who are going to be in school. Your teacher is an evolutionist and grades down those who disagree with him. You have an assignment to write a paper on the origin of life. What grade are you going to get? There's a class discussion that's going on, and the claim has been made in the discussion that either God is impotent or does not exist because there's evil in the world. And you say, what? How about pressure at work? Your boss gives you new sales literature, and the literature lies about the product you're selling. Your boss wants you to sign off on a padded expense list, includes you in his crime. Or maybe he even offers you a part of it. Here's one that's becoming more frequent. So you're hired with an understanding with your boss. You're not going to be working Sundays. New boss comes in, and guess what? Post a new schedule, and when are you scheduled for? Sunday mornings. What are you going to do? How about government pressure? Here's some new ones coming up. These have already happened in other states. You're a photographer. You have declined to work a homosexual wedding. You now have a lawsuit against you that's threatening your business license. That's your livelihood. Now what? How about this one? You're a nursing student, and new state law requires you to participate in abortion training. You've got to go in and watch it and help with it. You're on a public sidewalk. You're passing out gospel literature. A police officer arrests you and carts you away to jail. It's already happening in other states. Happened in Pennsylvania just 2 years ago. Again, these are real situations, and there's thousands more like them. You are going to be put to the test, and whether you obey God first and foremost or yield to the pressure to conform to some other standard, the test is going to be there. Your ability to stand firm is going to be based on your level of trust and submission to God, no matter what it is. God's purpose in these things coming is to train you. Do you remember 1 Corinthians 10:13? God is faithful. He will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will provide a way of escape that you may be able to endure it. These smaller tests are the things that lead up to bigger tests when it really is going to count. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah didn't face down King Nebuchadnezzar without having a lot of other things go on first. Remember chapter 1? It started for them with this, we're just not going to eat the king's meat. We'll leave that in God's hands. You can be sure there were lots of other things that came up along the way. They were trained in the ways of the Babylonians, weren't they? That 3 years. And that means all their religious stuff, all their philosophy, and a lot of that stuff is going to conflict greatly with what they know what the Word of God says. What would they have done in all those situations? They've already proven their character. They would have stood firm saying, this is what God says, this is what we will do. Other people may do the other stuff. We are going to follow God. And that way, when they finally came to the day that it meant their life, they stood up instead of bowed down. That's the kind of lives each of us need to live. And we get there by all the little tests that come up in life. Obey God rather than the pressures of men place upon you, the enticements that men place upon you, and let Him take care of your future, whatever it may be. Because the goal of your life isn't success. We talked about this morning. We were talking about finances in Sunday school. We'll be talking about it next week in Sunday school as well. But the goal of my life is what's going to determine success. And if the goal of my life is to love the Lord my God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, then I can pursue that regardless of what happens to me in the end. If it is to become conformed to the image of Christ, it is to serve God and those He places in front of my path, then that's success. And if I live tomorrow, so what? Was I faithful to do those things today? Because if I don't live tomorrow, I've just simply entered into eternity, and I'll continue to do the things that make me successful. But if I define success the way the world does, fame, position, power, finances, wealth, then I will cave, because I don't want to risk what I think is the purpose of my life. These men stood firm because they knew what life was about, and therefore they were willing to risk it all and yield everything to stick to it. They were going to fulfill their purpose in life. Well, this story has a happy ending, but there's some bad stuff that has to happen first. All right? Verse 19. They were very calm, yet very defiant, and Nebuchadnezzar completely loses it. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. His facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it is usually heated. And he commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes. They were cast in the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, and for this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. Now think about it. The king was irrational. If he really was that mad and wanted them to suffer, cool the fire. Don't heat it up, because then you live longer in the agony of it. The hotter it is, the faster it snuffs out your life. He heated it up. And the only thing that managed to do was kill the mighty men that were charged with casting them. Their deaths proved the lethality, that it was going to be deadly, because it was to these strong, valiant men, part of his army. In addition, usually victims of this type had their clothes taken off them. Their clothes would actually give them a little protection for a few minutes. They didn't want any of that. Instead, what we find here is they're tied up with everything on, including their caps. That's how mad he is. Urgency and haste, he became irrational. But the fact that their clothes were on them becomes a proof about in the miracle God's about to perform. Verse 24. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He responded and said to his high officials, was it not 3 men we cast bound in the midst of the fire? And they answered and said to the king, certainly, O king. He just wanted to make sure he had this right. 3, right? No one else, you know, just 3. Certainly, O king, verse 25. He answered and said, look, I see four men loose and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like the son of the gods. Now, this furnace was something like a modern lime kiln. You could feed material in the top, you could extract things from the side. So the king was able to look into the furnace and see what was going on. And he actually had set himself up so he could look in. He was looking forward to seeing these guys burn up. Nice guy, the king. So they're pushed in. He sees his men, his valiant men, are killed on the top of the furnace. Wait a minute. How many did we throw in there? There's three, but I see four. Not only that, they're walking around. Something's wrong with this picture, huh? And the fourth figure he sees, he says, has the appearance of a divine being. It literally is a son of the gods. His religious belief system is the god had sons and they would appear as divine men. Now, if you think about it as well, how would they be walking out? They're supposed to be tied up. Well, this does astound him. And there's an immediate change in Nebuchadnezzar. Look at verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of the blazing fire. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men, the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. So contrary to his earlier statement, the king now recognized there was a God who could rescue Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from his hands. And the king now acknowledges that they are servants of, and look at the title given here, the Most High God. That is an elevation. Remember when Daniel had interpreted the dream, he recognized that this God was a God of gods, but in a pantheon of gods, so what? There was probably quite a bit of hierarchy within the better gods. That's not the title here. This is the supreme one, the ultimate one, the final authority, the Most High God. And the evidence, the miraculous deliverance, is confirmed by three groups of top officials. The satraps are there, the prefects are there, the governors are there. These are the top in the land. They confirm what happened. They had seen it, but they also see Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego come out of this furnace. And here's the number of miracles. The ropes are burned away. All right? But nothing else. If the ropes were not burned away, they would have fell into the fire and they wouldn't be able to get up, much less walk around. Completely loose. Selective burning. Okay? Ropes are gone. There's no damage to them. Their flesh is not damaged. Any of you ever got near a fire and had it singe your hair? It doesn't take a whole lot, does it? Poof, it gets singed. And then it stinks, right? Their flesh is not harmed, their hair is not singed, and their clothes don't have the smell of smoke at all. You don't have to get in the fire to get the smoke on you, do you? I know some of you were at the bonfire last night. Did you go home a little smoky? You did. Don't even have to get that close to it. Not even the smell of smoke on them. Well, this changes Nebuchadnezzar with so radically. He gives a new decree. Look at verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants and put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the god of Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other god who is able to deliver in this way." Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. So he acknowledges that their defiance of his command was the right thing to do. They should have only worshiped their God. They were correct in doing this. He understood this was a challenge of the gods, and his God lost. Okay? He recognized this fourth man in the fire as an angel or messenger from God that protected them. And in the commentaries, there's lots of speculation on the identity of the angel. It's not necessary. The importance of the angel being there is that God sent the angel to protect Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and prove himself. That was the purpose of the angel. And since their God proved himself as the most high God in protecting them, now the king does not want anything to risk offending this God. Remember what Daniel had said in the vision? The power that you have, your kingdom, everything has come from this God. Now he's putting some feet on this thing. I'm not going to risk offending this God. I now understand. Daniel was right. This God is completely different than any God I've ever even heard about. He interprets mysteries. He can tell me the dreams through his servants, tell me the dreams I've dreamed and its interpretation, and he can rescue out of the midst of a burning fire. This is the Most High God. No one is allowed to speak against this God. No one is allowed to offend this God. Why? From the king's standpoint, you offend this God, I could be in trouble. Okay, that's where he is at this point. Understand, at this point, Nebuchadnezzar is still a proud, arrogant man. He has not come yet to understand that this is the only God. He still thinks of it as simply the supreme God in a pantheon of gods. We will see next week his change on this issue. He then gives the order that if you speak against this God, you're going to be torn apart in a horrible manner. That's a nasty death. And then we're going to dishonor your memory by making your house the public latrine. That was the same penalty he was going to put on the wise men back in chapter 2. He's not a nice guy, okay? And then he causes Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. And you can only imagine the chagrin of the Chaldeans at that. Right? They're even farther elevated. We don't like this. But what could they do about it? God has proven himself not only the Most High God by the manner in which he rescued these three servants, but also in the very long-suffering, patient dealings with Nebuchadnezzar. You think he would have got it when Daniel revealed the dream. You think he would have pursued, Daniel, tell me more about this God. He doesn't. He ends up setting this idol up, but it's another opportunity to God to demonstrate to this pagan king and to everybody else, he is the Most High God. The Babylonian pantheon is nothing because they're false gods. He should have done that. Instead, as we'll see next week, he will continue in his arrogance and his boasting. But God's going to bring him to the point of understanding the truth. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is forced to acknowledge the Lord is the Most High God. But at that point, this point, he's not ready to announce everything and abandon them all. Pride is still an issue. That's next week. The sad thing is that there's many people who are still the same way as Nebuchadnezzar. They have experienced all sorts of things that have forced them to acknowledge that there is a God that created them that is more powerful than they and whom they ought to serve. But they don't want to do it. They still refuse it. They're still resistant to yielding themselves to them. Even more so, I think, are professing believers who refuse to yield their own lives to God. They still want it their way. They want a foot in the world and a foot following him and hopefully, you know, balance it out and have the best of both worlds. No, there's one or the other. It's time to start trusting him. And yet God is so patient. That magnifies his character. He is patient with us. He's long-suffering with us, continually pushing to help us become conformed to the image of Christ. Don't be like those who simply add a God to your belief system but hold on to your old beliefs as well. Don't be like that. The Lord is God. There is no other. Follow him. Be like Hananiah, Azariah, Mishael. They proved to be wonderful examples of trusting God, submitting their lives to him. We will do well if we will follow that example. Because then you fulfill the purpose in your life, regardless of whatever circumstances follow it.